This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's a pleasure to welcome to Michigan and to Greening of the Great Lakes, Bill Francis, who's president of the Algalita Marine Research Institute. Bill was recently in Grand Rapids to address the Michigan Recycling Coalition's annual conference. Bill, nice to have you on the program.
Thank you very much. I'm very, very glad to have had a chance to speak to everyone in Michigan.
Well, Algalita is based in California, and one of your goals is to eliminate all the plastic waste in the oceans. And our conversation comes at a time when a Scripps Institution study suggests that the plastic trash in the Great Pacific Garbage Patch has increased 100-fold in the past 40 years, and Algalita is mentioned in that report. This is a huge problem, Bill.
Well, it certainly is. We're very glad that Scripps has validated some of the findings that we have made over the past 15 years. We're seeing an accumulation of more and more plastic in our oceans. It just doesn't go away. It's a wonderful material. Plastic was made to do some wonderful things, but it just doesn't ever go away, at least not in the ocean.
Bill, how does the plastic get into the ocean, and why does it aggregate the way it does?
Well, a couple of things. There is some that falls off of ships or is discarded from ships at sea, but our studies show that approximately 80% of the material in the ocean is land-based. A lot of it washes downstream, rivers, the ocean's downhill from everywhere. So a plastic bag flies out of the back of somebody's truck when they're not paying attention and eventually gets blown into the ocean. So we see it from all over, all kinds of sources. And not all is discarded by people who aren't paying attention. Some of it is just accidental.
And the fact that that this garbage patch has formed, apparently the size of Texas, why does that plastic aggregate? Why isn't it just floating around randomly?
The oceans are quite interesting. As you dig into it a little bit, the way the spinning of the Earth actually contributes to accumulation zones at approximately 30 degrees latitude north and south of the equator. These are what we call convergence zones, where the winds and the currents that are created tend to make materials that float accumulate in these big spinning areas, and it's called a gyre, G-Y-R-E. And these gyres are huge. So when we talk about something being the size of Texas or a couple of times the size of Texas, what we're really talking about is the convergence zone and where are things more concentrated. But in fact, floating material will wind up all over the oceans. There are five major gyres where these convergence zones, and that's where most of the material collects and concentrates. So that's one of the reasons we study in that area. It's a more consistent place to evaluate the overall increase in plastic pollution.
Now, I assume you've been out on the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. For our listeners, can you give us a visual of what that must be like? And it must be horrific.
Well, I've done some near shore stuff myself. I've not actually participated in the voyages out in the middle of the ocean. That takes somebody who's got a little more, ocean confident skills than I do. But I have been working with the people who've been out there for many years and seen lots of the film footage and photos. And it's really interesting. When you just look across the ocean, you really don't see anything. And then maybe you'll see something good-sized, like a fishing net, a derelict fishing gear floating on the surface. But you really don't see a lot. And then all of a sudden you start looking a little more closely. And you see these little specks, and you go, oh, what are those? And all of a sudden you see that just about everywhere you look, there are these small pieces of floating material. And this is pieces of plastic that have broken up over decades, and are now floating on the surface of the ocean.
And apparently, then these columns go straight down. I mean, there are columns of plastic that beneath the surface that, what I think they refer to them as like plastic columns or water columns or something like that.
Water column plastic will move up and down depending on the density. One of the things that we know through our studies and is a fact is that over 50% of the plastic that is manufactured is heavier than water. So a lot of it will actually sink. Then the other thing that happens is that lighter than water plastics, the more buoyant, can accumulate materials. You know, things can grow on them, and they can get encrusted, and over time they can also begin to sink. And some plastics are very near the density of water, and so they'll kind of bounce up and down, move up and down in that water column. And there has not been a lot of research done on the concentration of plastic at different levels in the ocean. It's just so difficult to do that type of work. There's not a lot has been done.
Let's talk about some of the initiatives at Algalita, some of the things that you folks are doing to ameliorate these problems.
One of our primary focuses is to engage the youth around the world. We have had a very, very successful method of introducing students and teachers to what's happening in our oceans related to plastic pollution. We have something called our Ship to Shore communication program, which is a blog that when we have an expedition going on where our researchers are sampling for plastic pollution in the ocean, where the students can send their questions to the crew while the expedition's going on. We have had an expedition here recently, and we've had almost 5,000 teachers and students register for participation in that blog. It's been a great way to communicate with them about the issue of plastic pollution.
Well, the fact that you've jumped on social media, I mean, you well know if you're going to reach young people and you're going to get their attention, you almost have to go through the social media networks, and blogging is certainly one way to do that.
Without a doubt. Another thing that's been very effective for us from an educational program is the preparation and distribution of a curriculum that demonstrates the issue of plastic pollution as it moves down through the watershed. We call it Watershed Wonders, and that's been adapted and utilized certainly in the state of California and Southern California. We're based in Long Beach, and that's been very successful as well. And then the other very significant item that has helped was our youth summit that we conducted in 2011. We had 100 students from 12 countries that all came into Long Beach and learned about plastic pollution, how they could go back to their communities and institute some type of positive change to reduce the amount of plastic pollution where they live.
Bill, what do you find when you talk to young people who come to these educational sessions? Are they passionate? Are you hopeful that the future generation will do a better job in terms of environmental sustainability than perhaps our generation has done?
It gives me chills to talk about it because I saw kids from Kenya, kids from Tasmania, kids from Guam, Canada, Central LA near Watts, all come together and share a passion for improving the planet that we live on and wanting to go back home and make a difference. It absolutely gives me hope for the future. The young kids that hear about this get it. They want to make a difference. They want to do the right thing. And they're the future decision makers that are going to help us change the world to make it a better place to live in. So there is hope. But we need to keep talking with them and give them the information so they can make the right decisions.
Bill, a few moments ago you mentioned the Ship to Shore interactive blog so that young people and teachers can follow some of your research expeditions. You've got an ongoing project. I think you call it the Japan Tsunami Debris Expedition. A little bit about that and the genesis of it and the goals and objectives.
The Japan tsunami was a horrible experience for the people of Japan. And our hearts go out to the families and the everyone there that lost so much. What it did do was create a unique opportunity for researchers who have already studied things in the Pacific Ocean to try to understand the impact of such a major natural catastrophe. So we looked at that, and because we've done a lot of work in the Pacific already, we decided to launch an expedition that would allow us to gather more information on plastic pollution and see if we could determine the changes from the debris that was cast into the ocean by the tsunami. So we put together an expedition in partnership with the Five Gyres Institute to follow the path of the tsunami and collect samples. And in doing so, we've been able to put other scientists, educators, environmentalists, filmmakers on the vessel. As a matter of fact, we also provided scholarship to a student from the Bahamas who's going to, I believe, make environmental science her career, so that we could help the world become more aware of the issues of plastic pollution. So we kind of rode something that was a tragedy and very, very interesting to people because of its uniqueness and its severity, trying to turn that into a positive and increase awareness of the whole issue of marine debris, trash, and specifically plastic pollution. That expedition started on May 2nd and will complete its journey on June 30th or July 1st on the island of Maui in Hawaii. We're very interested in what's happening there. The Hawaiian people, particularly on Maui, have been extremely receptive. The islands act as a filter for trash, and they get the trash gets into the ocean from all over the world, unfortunately washes up on the islands, and so they have to put up with what the rest of us have thrown into the ocean. So we're getting a lot of support from the community of Maui. They're very sensitive to the ocean and what's in it. So we're seeing this as a tremendous vehicle for letting the world know about the issue of plastic pollution and hopefully some of the things we can do to stop it.
My guest is Bill Francis, who's president of Algalita Marine Research Institute. Bill, you've also established a, speaking of education and outreach, but you've got a database on plastic pollution in our oceans. And that data, that would be data that you derive from all of your projects, including the Japan Tsunami Debris Expedition. But that's available in a central location so people can access that from their laptops and their desktops.
That's exactly right. We're very pleased that the 1st of May, coincidental with the launch of our expedition through the Japan Tsunami Debris Field, we have the geographical information system launched that is available for anybody that goes online to our www.algalita.org website. And they can look at this map, click on the individual locations of samples that have been taken historically, and get all the accurate information on exactly how much plastic was there, when it was gathered, what the conditions were during its capture, and what the analysis showed us. That's what we want to do. We want to have people see our data. We want to share what we have learned so that people can use it properly. And then the second phase is to hopefully have other organizations and citizen scientists provide us with information that we can put onto that geographical information system so that we can share their information as well.
Bill, we've got about a minute left, and I wish I could talk to you all day. But what was the take-home message that you gave the people in Michigan at the Recycling Coalition's conference in Grand Rapids, probably in the context of our Great Lakes as well? And then let's conclude with how folks who are interested in saving our oceans can support your research institute.
Well, the take-home is that you can make a difference. Algalita is very small. We're a tiny, tiny organization, but we're passionate and we provide accurate information, and that resonates well across the world. So each person in Michigan or Paris, France, or Brazil can make a difference by making good decisions about what you buy, what type of packaging you use, and how you handle that packaging when you're finished with it. Try to use different materials rather than plastic if you can. And I guess the way that I would hope people could help is take a look at the organization. There's a book out by our founder, Captain Charles Moore, called Plastic Ocean. That's a good read. If you go to our website, we're always looking for new members. And, of course, funding, we're a 501c3 nonprofit. That's always an issue, and we'd welcome anybody that would like to contribute in any way.
And that website is www.algalita.org, and that's A-L-G-A-L-I-T-A.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, this week we welcome back to the show Dan Wyant. Dan is the director of the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. And Dan, the last time we talked, you were just a couple of months into the job, and now you're a seasoned veteran.
Yeah, Kirk, a year and a half, not quite a year and a half, actually. Did enjoy last time we talked about where we were headed, and we've got a good sense of it now. Leaders in environmental stewardship, full partner in economic development, excelling at customer service. But the DEQ has a responsibility to protect public health and the environment of Michigan.
Well, there are a lot. I mean, there couldn't be a place that's in the middle of so many issues right now than public health and environment. I mean, that is the— I don't need to tell you this. Let's start with one of those issues that was recently in the media in mid-Michigan. You call these LUSTs, L-U-S-T, leaking underground storage tanks. Michigan's had a problem with this for a long time. There's a backlog, but maybe the cleanup will be a little easier now with some new legislation?
Yeah, you're right. A lot of issues. Everything from fracking to land use to invasive species, but contaminated sites because of Michigan's industrial legacy. Both on the industrial side, but also on leaking underground storage tanks. Mm-hmm. So a story was written and identified. We probably have over 7,000 sites in Michigan, and it's a big issue for us, both because of existing contamination, our concerns about it getting into drinking water. But we've done a number of things here recently. We have passed legislation, the governor signed it, and it will streamline our program, allow us to use risk-based assessments so that we can close sites down quicker, get more environmental cleanup, one. Two, there's a refined petroleum fund, and that fund was used to administer other parts of the DEQ, quite honestly, over time, because there was no general fund. Not pointing fingers of blame at any past administration, but we're putting money back towards and $10 million this year, $10 million next year. So we're going to put resources into cleaning up these underground sites.
It's not cheap. One of the sites, as you know, is in Lansing, Michigan. And that was over $1 million to remediate that site, right?
Yeah, these are expensive. And it is, even I've looked at this, I'm kind of new to it, and it just boggles my mind to see the cost. But you've got to go in, dig down, identify the extent of the plume, and you've got to take that soil out and put it into an approved landfill, so you know this will never get out into the environment. So they're costly. And a lot of people ask, why aren't we going after the polluters? I mean, make those polluters pay. And the reality is gasoline gas stations have consolidated dramatically. The downturn in the economy, we don't have on some of these sites responsible parties that we can identify anymore. They just closed up shop and they're gone. And it is a dilemma. We do have the ability to go after those who have polluted. And when we identify that they're responsible, we do that. We've got civil means to go after penalties, fines, and they do have to pay for the remediation. The reality is there are just a lot of what we call orphan sites where there's just nobody around, and we do have to be proactive just so we're protecting the public.
Yeah, and as I understand it, some of these sites, the tanks have been long removed, but the leakage occurred before the removal of the tanks. So going back maybe 40 or 50 years.
Yeah, that's right, Kirk. And, you know, the good news really is most of these sites, the vast majority of them are fairly old and existing, and they're known, and we're monitoring them, we're controlling them, and we're focusing on those that have the most potential to cause risk. And to date, especially, you know, per that story in most places, I'm not aware of any where it has actually gotten into the drinking water and contaminated the drinking water. So that's good news. Going forward, rules and regulations have been changed, so we're not going to see as many problems. So this is the other piece that we need to talk about. Technology's changed, regulations have changed, so now we've got lined tanks, we've got less connectors, we've got more training, we've got certification requirements. So we don't expect to see problems like we have seen historically, but I don't want to take away from the fact that we've got these 7,000 sites we've got to deal with.
And so as the backlog gets reduced, you're not going to see any new sites going forward because of the new regulations.
Basically. Doesn't mean problems won't happen, just like the golf spill. If they're not managed right, you can still have issues, but the technology has greatly improved. The management has greatly improved. And to some extent, because of the consolidation of the industry, the players in the industry are, I'll just say this, I think better managers, and we're not seeing the problems that we saw in the past.
And we just know a lot more about environmental degradation than we did back in the day.
We sure do. And again, I'll just circle back to your original comment. We're going to close more sites. The law change was going to allow us to do that, and we are going to put more resources. So we're going to be more aggressive at getting after this problem.
My guest is Dan Wyant, the director of the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. Dan, you just mentioned hydraulic fracturing a while ago. This fracking issue has become quite controversial in some states in particular. A lot of our listeners may not know that Michigan has been involved in monitoring natural gas extraction for like 50 years and without too many problems.
Yeah, this is a really big issue. It's a national issue. It's an international issue, and it's debated at two levels, actually. There's an energy policy side. That's the biggie, I call it. And then there's the little e, the environmental impact on the locals, whether it's going to contaminate your groundwater. And so we see a lot of stories nationally, and it's got people quite concerned. It's important to note Michigan has been an oil and gas state for a long time. Mining, oil, and gas has been part of our natural resource history for over 80 years. We've been fracking in Michigan for 50 years. We've got 12,000 wells that have been fracked in Michigan over that time period without significant environmental impact. Again, it doesn't mean it can't happen. We're very proud in Michigan that we've got, we think, the model regulatory program. And so we evaluate water use and run it through a water use assessment tool. We have significant requirements on the casing, and we monitor pressure. We can tell whether or not there is a problem. If it were to happen, we collect that wastewater, and then we put out information with respect to the chemicals that are being used in the fracking fluid. So it's a very comprehensive, and then we monitor where that wastewater, when it comes back from the fracking process, goes. And unlike other states who put it in wastewater treatment plants, we put it in deep well injection, which is a process where it'll never be in the environment. But very controversial. A lot of people still are suspect. We're going to continue to monitor and then also adapt our program as needed as we go forward.
I listened to an environmental attorney from Ohio at a panel discussion where one of your people was involved, and actually using some of Michigan's regulations as a model to ramp up Ohio's. One thing Ohio's doing I thought that was kind of interesting, and I need to ask you this. If they find that the water supply has been contaminated in a community by a fracking process, the company that's responsible has to pay for
it. Yeah.
Do we have that same
provision? Yeah, we already have that requirement. So you know, we have a polluters pay law in Michigan, and that would be required that they would have to remediate, and then they would have to provide a water supply to the impacted party. So, again, they would have to make sure that there's safe drinking water supply, and then they would have to remediate the problem, go in, and we had the Enbridge oil spill. I mean, this is a classic example where we had a pretty significant spill, and the Enbridge company had to go in, and they're cleaning up the river. Anybody that had that in Michigan would have to deal with that.
And that Enbridge situation, frankly, from my perspective, was one of the best examples of collaboration among agencies, even Enbridge. I mean, it really stepped up big time. I mean, there's still a little work to be done, but you guys have been on that.
You know, that is a great story and one that we probably don't talk enough about. That happened before I became director of the Environmental Department of Environmental Quality. Wasn't on my watch, but it was. I inherited it along with EPA Region 5. It has been a great partnership between federal government, state government, local government, and then the affected parties, public health locally, and then the neighbors. and the Enbridge Company. Quite a bit has been spent on it. They've opened up about 3 miles of the river. A large part of it will be opened up later this summer, so a significant amount of work. And in many cases, again, I got to be careful when I say this, in many cases, in many parts, it'll be cleaner than it was before. Mm-hmm. But again, I don't want to diminish the impact. It was significant. And there are other areas, wetlands and other impacts that, you know, we'll see some impact longer term.
And briefly before we take a break here, back to the fracking for a minute. We've talked to several people on this show, including Becky Humphreys, whom you know well, Patty Burkholz and others. But Michigan has monitored this fracking so well that there really hasn't been one significant episode over those 50 years where there's been contamination from a fracking well.
You know, we had one incident since I've been here in a year and 4 months where they had a surface spill. They immediately shut down. They remediated it, and it never got into the environment. And so I'm always a little careful to say but we haven't had in the 12,000 fracking experiences in Michigan an environmental impact. And so it is important to recognize that. We've been able to do that. We, though, recognize going forward, technology is changing. We are going deeper. We are going further.
And horizontally.
And we are going horizontally. And so as this technology changes, we have to be on top of that and make sure our number one priority is environmental stewardship, and we have to make sure that if we're going to allow this technology, that we're not going to negatively, adversely impact the environment.
Let's take Lake Erie. We got a problem with algae in Lake Erie, unfortunately. Very complex situation, a lot of causes. What is the DEQ doing?
Yeah, this is a big challenge, but it is our highest priority, one we want to spend the most time on, because I think it's the most significant opportunity to make progress on water quality. It relates to non-point source pollution, and some of it's point source, but we've done a really good job historically of controlling what comes out of the end of a pipe and what comes out of the end of a smokestack. I think our biggest challenge going forward is this non-point source stuff, and it is complicated. We do have a pretty good sense of the sources of the problem, and so we know there's a significant amount of agricultural runoff. Mm-hmm. We know that's a major contributor, one. We know that invasive species are a contributor. We know that the zebra mussel and the quagga mussel has created, again, a situation where light can go further down into Lake Erie. And so we know that when you put light, energy, and nutrients together, you create a perfect environment.
Algal for blooms.
Algal blooms, and we take oxygen out of the water. It affects fish. Clog the water where, again, boats can't travel and recreate, and then there's some issues with public health on beaches. So it's just a terrible situation. We have to do more. Michigan's done a lot, and it's important to recognize this. We have a contributor, too, in Detroit Water and Sewer creates heavy water events. We get raw sewage overflow because we don't have the capacity when we get these huge rains and these runoff events. And so we're a contributor, too, in Michigan. Ohio has a lot more of the agriculture responsibility because of the vast amount of ag land adjacent to Lake Erie.
Along the southern shore there. Yep.
Michigan's a lot smaller percent. We do have Detroit Water and Sewer that is a contributor, and we're working with them, and we're making great progress over time to lower the amount of nutrient loading that goes into Lake Erie from that source. Michigan, we've got significant initiatives going on. We've got the MEEP program, Michigan Agriculture right. Environmental Stewardship Program, putting best practices on farms. We have all our large CAFOs under permit, NPDES, and so they have discharge limitations. Again, I mentioned Detroit Sewer and Water. We've taken phosphorus out of lawn furniture, lawn fertilizer, and so we've also taken it out of laundry detergent. So we dissolved phosphorus is the single A nutrient that's causing the issue, and so we're doing a lot of phosphorus controls in Michigan. Ohio hasn't done as much as we have. I'm not pointing fingers, but I think they're looking at Michigan as an example, and we'll probably see more initiative out of them.
Dan, what happened? I mean, Lake Erie was virtually a dead lake at one point, and then there was so much progress over 20 to 30 years, and then all of a sudden this. I mean, why did this reemerge?
Yeah, you know, I think it's all three of the things we've talked about. The three things being
the invasives.
The invasives right. really created, again, a different situation that allowed light nutrients to come together, and it created a perfect growing environment. We have to recognize that as a major contributor. We have to recognize that runoff in farms is a significant issue, knowing that we're farming very intensively now because agriculture has done well and commodity prices are high, and so farmers are. So we really want to do more with respect to conservation practices on farms, and we need to do more. And then these big wet weather events. I mean, let's just recognize we've had significant wet weather events, right? Weather patterns have been extreme. They're not as consistent. And so we get these big rains, we get more runoff, and that's been part of our problem.
Let's go from the lakes for a moment to wetlands restoration and encouraging people to bring those. You mentioned agriculture is really going gangbusters, but a lot of these farmers do have wetlands, and some people are interested in restoring them.
They are, and we are going to see a reform package introduced in the legislature in the next week or two. The Michigan Wetlands Program was on the block to be sent back to the federal government about 2 years ago. The Snyder administration, I believe strongly that we should keep the wetlands program in Michigan. We're one of two states that have delegated authority to administer the Clean Water Act. Michigan has this great heritage of wetlands protection, and we want to maintain that. And good news is we've turned the corner. The legislature is appropriating money to keep the program. We're putting reforms so we can do more wetland mitigation. We are going to create some flexibility to allow locals to have input of where development should occur. And we recognize this balance that has to exist between economic development but protection. But it's a strong recognition that these wetlands are absolutely critical with respect to water quality, habitat, for wildlife.
They're great filters for the whole ecosystem, essentially.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so we're really working hard to communicate the value of wetlands in Michigan to deal with these water quality issues. They are a filter. They control floods. They control runoff, and they create this great habitat for fish and wildlife that really lends to the great natural resource, and there's economic benefit to that. So we're really promoting that. We will maintain a strong wetlands protection program in Michigan.
Dan, I want to make sure I'd be remiss if I didn't congratulate you guys on your Michigan Green Leader Award that you recently received from the Detroit Free Press. They sponsor that. And we've interviewed a lot of green leaders, but you have this Retired Engineer Technical Assistance Program. You call it RETAP. That's a long word, but RETAP is a pretty cool thing where apparently you've got retired engineers that are going to help businesses.
Yeah, this is a great program. Retired engineers. And all throughout society, we're seeing this. Teachers, another program, but this is great. Retired engineers who have worked in environmental areas are lending their services to companies to go in and do energy assessments. And we're averaging $50,000 of energy savings per company that So people need to contact us at the DQ. They can look at our website, and this is available to small companies. We target
free of charge.
Mm-hmm. And so we've got a small federal grant to allow this program. We've got, I can't remember the number, but I know it's over 40 retired engineers are working together. And the Detroit Free Press this year recognized this program as one of the outstanding green leaders programs in the state.
Yeah, I mean, what a great way to use some resources in the state of Michigan. And these engineers probably just love going out to these companies and sitting down and saying, let's try a few things.
They do. And so, again, recognize this. Great experience, great background, and people want to continue to add something back. And so it is a model program. It's not regulatory. This is where we want to, again, get into compliance assistance and being proactive to do more environmental stewardship. This is as the governor talks about reinvention, this is a classic way that we go proactively so that we can help people become greener and better environmental stewards.
Dan, we've got about a minute left here. I like to ask this question. It's not an easy question, but as you look forward, we've talked about a lot of the great things that you do. From where you sit as the head of the DEQ, what worries you the most as you look over the next couple of years?
You know, three issues. We talked about one of them. Invasive species is the one that keeps you up. You can't control it, but it has a great impact. Aquatic invasives, we know that plant and animal disease. We certainly know that foodborne illness, all those affect us in the quality of life group. That's one. Two is this non-point source issue. These water quality issues, I think, is our real opportunity to do more. And we got to get more proactive, and we need everybody's help to do that. And the land use has always been out there. That's the one. I thought those are the big issues as we look forward. Fragmentation, land use, making sure that we're protecting this vast natural resource that we have in Michigan. Michigan's got this tremendous resource, water, land, air, and it's why people come here to live, work, and play.
Well, you're wearing your Pure Michigan shirt proudly today, and no one is more responsible for Pure Michigan than the Department of Environmental Quality. Dan, it's so good to see you again. Best of luck going forward. I mean, there's an awful lot on your plate, but it sounds like you're making great strides.
Kirk, good to be with you again.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
Turn it up, a little bit higher. Radio, turn it up, burn it up, so you know, radio.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Here's the May 4th Michigan State University commencement address from former Irish President Mary Robinson.
President Simon, Vice President Gray, Gura Mahagath, thank you for the Irish with which you welcomed me forward. Faculty and graduating students and your families, it's an honor, a real honor, to give the keynote address at this convention for graduating seniors at Michigan State University. It's also special to receive an honorary degree in the good company of Robert Scandalarius, in that we can now not only feel linked with Michigan State, but describe ourselves as the class of 2012. And at my stage, that's a nice feeling, the class of 2012. I'm aware of the fine reputation of Michigan State, and I read quite a bit about the areas of study here. But I must say, even since I've come, I've been particularly impressed by the areas of focus. You tackle some of the world's toughest problems to find solutions that make life better, from alternative energy to better food safety to breakthroughs in medical and environmental applications, including on women's health. MSU is one of the top research universities in the world, but you are also proud, and rightly, of the quality of your undergraduate teaching, and you are one of the greenest campuses in the nation. It actually makes me feel at home to see the sea of green in front of me. I feel as an Irish person. All of this has led me to conclude that the seniors graduating from such a university must be an interesting group in themselves, with a lot to offer. A group worth challenging. And I do want to challenge you with another tough problem. I know that many of you carry a burden of debt from your college years, and that this isn't an easy time to find work, find jobs here in the United States, or indeed anywhere in the world. But I still want to challenge you, as I have myself been challenged. The challenge is the injustice of the threat of climate change. I came to this issue not as a scientist or from an environmental perspective, but as someone working in the area of human rights. Having served for 5 years as United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, I was concerned that the world needed to put more emphasis on protecting and promoting economic and social rights, rights to food and safe water, health, education, and shelter. So in October 2002, I set up a small organization in New York called Realizing Rights, with colleagues based with me in New York and in Washington and Geneva. For 8 years, we focused on supporting African countries to tackle these issues and to benefit more from globalization so that they could bring their populations out of poverty. I learned that there was a growing problem. Climate change was very much beginning to affect food production, the livelihoods of subsistence farmers. I was invited as Honorary President of Oxfam to join with Archbishop Desmond Tutu at a hearing in Cape Town just before the Copenhagen Climate Conference in November 2009. We were invited to hear witness evidence, if you like, from five African farmers from different countries. And four of those African farmers were women, which was accurate because more than 80% of the farming is done by women, although they own less than 2% of the land. As we listened, the reality of their lives came home to me. The first farmer was a rooibos tea farmer from South Africa. She was there with her husband, and she looked worn and weary because she'd had a small rooibos farm that had allowed a reasonable income, but now there was a change in the whole weather pattern in the part of South Africa, and she could no longer grow rooibos anymore. The one man was from Kenya. He was a pastoralist, down to his last 20 goats from a herd of more than 200. The woman from Uganda has become a good friend of mine, Constance O'Kellett, and in a way, I listen to her a lot because we meet quite frequently. She's become now a climate-wise woman and speaks out at universities in this country and at climate conferences to bring home the human dimensions. She talks about growing up in her village in northern Uganda. They were poor but had enough food because they had seasons and they knew when to sow and they knew when to harvest. But about 8 years prior to this hearing in Cape Town with Archbishop Tutu, the weather pattern had changed. And instead of having regular seasons, they had long periods of drought and then flash flooding and then another long period of drought and then flash flooding again. It has destroyed the school and it's made food production so much harder. So she had brought together a women's group to try to hold the community together and try to learn to be more resilient. The woman from Mali was a cotton farmer, and cotton grows well in Mali, and she'd had a good, reasonable living, but again, because of drought, the cotton was no longer growing in the part of Mali where she was. The saddest one of all was the woman from Malawi, who had been farming in her part of Malawi, which now was subject to long periods of rain. They'd always had rainy seasons, but now the seasons were much longer and had destroyed her farm. And then she said something that stays with me. She said, "And some of the women in our village are selling their bodies, but I can't do that because I'm HIV positive." And I began to realize something that really devastated me, that climate shocks are undermining food security and nutrition and livelihoods throughout different parts of Africa. As some of you may know, because I know that Michigan State University has a great focus for a long time on food production and support for African countries. I learned at a climate conference in Rwanda that the whole continent of Africa is responsible for less than 4% of these greenhouse gas emissions which are contributing to global warming. They may not be the only thing that's causing the climate changes locally in countries and towns and villages and slum areas in Africa. There's also been bad cutting down of trees for firewood, bad soil management. But there's no doubt a very dramatic change is taking place already. It's not a thing of the future, and it's affecting people. So I decided to return to Dublin, which I was planning to do anyway, and I have established a small foundation called the Mary Robinson Foundation Climate Justice. It brings human rights, development, and the impact of climate change together. It bridges science, development, and human rights. And I myself am in a steep learning curve in my mid-60s. So I can identify with the learning curve you went through to get to where you are now as graduating seniors. It's actually a very good thing at any stage in life to be challenged by learning a lot, as I am, about the whole science and economics and finances of climate change. And it's a tough challenge. We want to change the narrative on climate change and make it more people-centered. What impact is it having on people, and how are they coping? As you may know, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, recently issued a special report on managing the risks of extreme events and disasters to advance climate change adaptation. Here in the United States, in the past year, you've had the highest number of climate extreme events, costing over $1 billion. But the United States is a climate-resilient country. Those extreme weather shocks are happening in poor countries without insurance or coping methods. The other side of the coin is the need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions urgently to stay below the 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. We need to move from fossil fuel to renewable energy. The United Nations has declared 2012 the year of access to energy for all as we prepare for the big Rio Plus 20 conference next month. What about the 1.3 billion people who have no access to electricity and instead rely on kerosene and candles to light their home? What about the 2.7 billion who rely on firewood, animal dung, or coal for heating and cooking? And of course, most of those 2.7 billion are women and suffer from inhaling smoke and have adverse health effects. I heard recently that more women in developing countries die of the ingested smoke in their lungs than die of malaria. So it's a huge health issue. And we could do something about that because now we have clean cookstoves. It's how to get those clean cookstoves to the 2.7 billion who need them. How are we to scale up access to electricity for those hundreds, even thousands of millions, so that they can benefit, as so many are doing, from the mobile phone, for example? Can you think of ways to scale up access to affordable, renewable energy for poor populations? If you can, it will help them to come out of poverty, and it will also help to reduce emissions. Let me share briefly my own targets set for the next few years with my colleagues in the Foundation. We're focusing on four areas, and I'll just give you them as examples so that you might think yourselves about this challenge. First of all, we're creating awareness of the negative impact of climate change on food and nutrition so that we know that we have to work harder on adaptation and innovative science and get more money, more funding for adaptation. Secondly, we're working on bringing out the gender dimension of climate change, that climate impacts are often worse for women because of their roles as food producers, farmers, firewood collectors, and homemakers, and that women also tend to be the agents of change in coping with climate impacts. Thirdly, we're looking at one way to scale up access to affordable renewable energy for the poorest by linking those involved in government social protection systems in poor countries with those who provide energy to poor consumers, clean cookstoves, light in the home, solar lights, etc. And this is an approach that we'll bring both to the G20 and to Rio Plus 20. Finally, we're working with the World Resources Institute, based in Washington, D.C., to produce a report on issues of climate justice by 2014 as a contribution to thinking about equity, about common but differentiated responsibilities and respective capabilities, and about the right to development of poor populations in large countries like India, China, Brazil, etc. These are only some of the challenges, and from looking at the kind of instruction you've had and the opportunities for research here in Michigan State, I have no doubt that you can really engage in some of these areas. We're also faced with the fastest increase in population ever in those very countries which are affected in their food production by climate change. We need appropriate policies in this area, and we know what works. Education for girls and women, including in reproductive health and family planning, together with effective health systems that reduce maternal and child mortality. If that is available, population growth declines. The demographics are very clear, and every development expert knows this. However, sadly, in many ways, the world is going backwards on programs to support reproductive health and family planning. So we need a wake-up call. We need young people to say, look, we're looking at the picture in a holistic way, and we see the need to scale up, not reduce, support for reproductive health and family planning. So as I said, I've come to the issue of climate change from a human rights perspective. I'd like to end my challenge to you by putting it in the frame of a poem by Seamus Heaney, who was the Nobel laureate in 1995. He wrote a poem for Amnesty International for the 40th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1998. And the poem is called From the Republic of Conscience. It's about somebody who travels to the Republic of Conscience. And at the end of the first stanza, it says, "You carried your own burden, and very soon your symptoms of creeping privilege disappeared. And then in the Republic of Conscience, you have a mystical experience." And I want to just read you the last verse, stanzas. "I came back from that frugal republic with my two arms the one length, the customs woman having insisted my allowance was myself. The old man rose and gazed into my face and said that was official recognition that I was now a dual citizen. He therefore desired me, when I got home, to consider myself a representative and to speak on their behalf in my own tongue. Their embassies, he said, were everywhere, but operated independently, and no ambassador would ever be relieved." What Amnesty has done with that idea of an ambassador of conscience is create an award for people, and the Amnesty Ambassador of Conscience Award. But for me, what that poem is, it's about looking into your conscience and becoming a dual citizen, a citizen of conscience, as well as a citizen of whatever country you happen to be a citizen of. So my challenge to you, because I have great faith in the senior graduating class here in Michigan State, knowing the opportunities that you've had, my challenge to you is to become dual citizens, ambassadors of conscience, and tackle these urgent challenges that need the very skills and intellectual strengths that you've obtained here in Michigan State. I warmly congratulate each of you. I'm delighted to be part of your class of 2012. Thank you very much indeed.
That was the May 4th Michigan State University commencement address from former Irish President Mary Robinson. Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.